Live from the University of Texas at Austin, the Liberal Arts Development Studio and the Department of Government present Introduction to American Government with your professors, Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel.
I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
You know, we got a skeletal crew today. Seems like summer has hit. Professor McDaniel and I are alone in a room, and hopefully we're looking at the right camera. So forgive us if we sort of dart mischievously in the wrong direction. Well, you guys survived the first midterm exam. We had, maybe like half a dozen or so technical issues, I think all of which were resolved. Sometimes a resolution meant that there was a quick and kind of fairly painless rescheduling, but the grades will be unveiled by the time you guys see this particular in the news segment. Now, we want to emphasize again that you've got multiple components to the class. You've got the in the news segments, the modules, the web text, as well as the exams. It's not difficult necessarily to gauge where you are in the class at a given point in time, but remember, you're accumulating points. And at any given point in time, if you want to come to office hours and talk with myself or Professor McDaniel, we can kind of show you where you are in the course of the class. But, you know, since people turn things in at different points in time, it's not always easy to go on Canvas and figure out where you are vis-a-vis the rest of the class. So, you know, again, keep in mind the total points that are possible in the class, and you want to be working towards, you know, some huge, you know, magnificent percentage of that, right? You consult your syllabus, you'll see the total points and kind of our thoughts with respect to the grade point cutoffs, and as well, consult the video that we did at the beginning of class where we sketched out what would happen if we had a curve, and Professor McDaniel and I are anticipating we'll probably have a slight curve, okay? So use the reference material to establish where you are in the class, and certainly follow it up with personal contact with Professor McDaniel and I yourself. Just so we want to make sure you guys are not lost, that you guys know where you are in the class, know where you stand. Other than that, things are progressing pretty well. How you doing?
Doing great.
Right. Looking sharp. Looking sharp.
Thank you. This is my my summer outfit. I did bring in a shirt, but I was like, it's just too hot.
I know. Got some nice rain yesterday, so that was pretty cool.
Yes.
All right, so we're going to cover three topics in our fourth in the news segment today. A couple briefly up top. They're obviously important and relevant. And then we're going to talk about the Iranian situation, the standoff for tensions between the United States and Iran. We're going to talk about the immigration issue, and particularly a deportation situation or a planned deportation initiative that the Trump administration had considered last weekend. And then we're going to talk about the Democratic nomination debates, which are going to be Wednesday and Thursday of this week. We'll talk more extensively about those debates. We've kind of saved it for a while. It's time to talk some electoral politics, all right? But let's start with the foreign policy situation. So, Professor McDaniel, you want to set the table? What's going on with Iran? How is it relevant for American politics class?
Well, so the tensions have been building between the U.S. and Iran. Specifically, the Iranians have been accused of setting mines within shipping lanes. And so it's seen as, again, direct military action. Furthermore, Iran has discussed violating the nuclear arms deal that was set up, one that was really set up with President Obama, I think renegotiated by President Trump. And so President Trump actually was going to call for direct military action against Iran, but called it off about a couple hours before it was going to go into effect. And one of the things that's been pointed out is that you kind of had two camps. You had one that was very hawkish. And so you think of, again, former UN ambassador Bolton, and then the Secretary of Defense, Pompeo, who were very hawkish and wanted to use for military action. But then you also have those who are kind of easing back on that. Now, there was some action taken specifically through the use of through cyber attacks on Iran to basically demonstrate some level, basically high level displeasure with the way that the Iranians are reacting and kind of the increased aggressive nature of the nation. Now, one of the things that's important to note about this when we think about what happened within the Trump administration is you kind of have two camps going on, and you see a bit of indecision on the part of the president because of really, do I take direct military action? And again, this is a president who's been very open to using direct military action to defend the interests of the nation and to push back, against those he may see as aggressive towards the nation. But at the same time saying, okay, well, what will the actual cost of this be? Now, again, President Bush has also been very isolationist. And so you have this issue of, well, do we take direct military action? But this is also kind of violate my the idea of, you know, keeping the U.S. out of foreign issues. And one of the things that's also important, and Professor Shaw and I talked about this, is that even in the executive branch, you have different ideologies or different ways of seeing the world going on and competing with each other. And that sometimes you may not have a unified vision. And I think with this type of direct military action, where, again, the risk and the cost can be very high, that you want to make sure that everybody is on board and everybody is seeing things the same way. Because once this happens, there's really no going back. And so I think this is one of those things where you see the president really trying to contend with the various ideologies, with his various stances that may come in conflict with each other, but also the stances of those within his administration that may come into conflict with each other.
Yeah, it's a... You know, it's an interesting situation for the president, right? President Trump came into office after a 2016 campaign in which he pledged to end U.S. involvement in Iraq, to end U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, to bring our troops home, and to really kind of orient his foreign policy around a fairly narrow interpretation of American interests, right? We were only going to be directly engaged when American interests were directly in play. And so here you have this situation in Iran, and for those of you who haven't been paying attention, that would include a lot of us, including myself in some sense, you know, what's happened over the last 3 or 4 months is that, you know, this deal that the United States had gone into with Iran, this nuclear deal, in which Iran agreed to basically forestall its development of a nuclear program kind of as a precursor to becoming a nuclear bomb producer. Iran said, okay, we're going to give you 10 years. We're not going to enrich uranium, plutonium to an extent that can lend itself to making nuclear weapons. In exchange for that, you all, the Western countries, Russia, United States, are going to end your economic sanctions that you've had on us. That's the bones, the nuts and bolts of the nuclear deal. Trump and the Republicans thought it was a bad deal. A lot of the provisions of it were front-loaded. In other words, the sanctions, the economic sanctions and other things came off immediately. But Iran didn't really have to hit any of these mileposts until kind of further down this 10-year deal. Now, interestingly, this was not a treaty that was negotiated between the United States and Iran, right? If you know, going back to our recitation of the Constitution, you may say, well, you know, how can Trump simply pull out of a treaty without consent of the Senate? There was no treaty. This was an executive agreement. And it's part of the executive's kind of takeover of foreign policy that Professor McDaniel and I will talk a lot about in the presidency module. Okay, so that's kind of an interesting touchstone point, right? That, you know, this whole thing is the result of a presidential deal. And you see kind of the limits of executive agreements here. Right. The executive agreement is in force as long as the executive is in office. Once Obama left, Trump was really under no obligation to continue to honor this agreement. Now, to some foreign countries, this comes as a bit of a surprise. Like, well, wait a sec, I thought we had a deal. So at any rate, the United States reinstated its economic sanctions. Now, the other countries involved did not. So the European countries and Russia, they're still doing some business with Iran. But the United States has put pressure on them not to do business. So there's no formal sanctions in place amongst a lot of these countries. But there are informal sanctions with the United States heading the way. A lot of banana oil. I apologize for the long setup. But the long setup is by way of saying the Iranians are feeling the pinch of these economic sanctions. And so they've stepped up their kind of aggressiveness with respect to checking shipping in the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz, which is where I think 70 to 80% of the world's oil comes through that strait. And in fact, we do not know this, but there's a suspicion that they've been behind a couple of mines and bombs that have gone off in that area. And so this was all the precursor for Trump basically considering a military strike at one of these nuclear facilities. one of these defense slash nuclear facilities. And apparently it was going to happen, as Professor McDaniel said, hawks in the administration, hawks meaning more aggressive military, you know, pro-military people. You know, they said this was appropriate, this was measured, this was the way to go. It would show Iran that we mean business. But Trump called off at the last minute. His explanation, and he actually said this in a public interview, which is also unusual, he said that he did not think it was proportionate, that the estimates were that about 125 Iranian civilians and military workers would be killed in the strike. And he thought that was too much, given what had happened. So it's an interesting call. As Professor McDaniel said, this is, for us, this is fascinating, right? Because after the fact, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the United States House, said Trump couldn't have done this without congressional authorization, it would have been unconstitutional, right? Which is an interesting question, right? So we're looking at this, you know, it's an important event. There are lives involved. There's the potential for escalation. And all of that is important, but from a theoretical perspective, we're looking at it and thinking, you know, it shows, you know, the limits of the president, his or herself, negotiating executive agreements, right? That was, you know, the lack of a treaty here is the whole reason that Trump could kind of end the, you know, this cooperative era, brief cooperative era with Iran. Turmoil within the administration, conflict within the administration says even when the president wants to do something, he's limited. You know, he's limited by his campaign promises about not getting involved in foreign wars. You know, he's limited by, you know, the extent to which there is agreement within the administration on what to do. And then you've got this other actor, Congress, saying, you know, you shouldn't do that. They're the opinions of allies. All of this stuff, you know, politics is complicated, my friends. It is a complex system. And we just find this fascinating, this relative interplay of different actors, both within the federal government, outside the federal government, including American opinion, world opinion. It's all there. And, you know, it's all on display here. So we just want to connect some of those dots for you and get you thinking about these things in those terms as well. So a similar but more domestic oriented, I say similar in the sense that Professor McDaniel and I were talking before class, and the deportation situation in the United States is similar in the sense that there was dissensus within the administration on what to do and how to do it. Once again, it's an example of an issue in which the conflict between state and federal government, between the actors in the federal government, Congress, the courts, and the executive are all on display. So, Professor McDaniel, you've been following this one, I think. What's going on with the deportation situation?
So, President Trump made an announcement that he would have raids. So, he had basically a set of massive raids to deport, I want to say close to a million undocumented immigrants. And it was interesting because at the last second it was called off.
Yeah, this was last weekend they were planning on doing this.
And so what's interesting is that there is, with the situation with Iran, nobody knew about the attacks. They knew later on that it was called off. But this was a public announcement of what was going to happen, only for it to be called off. And so you have two situations with the president or where there's a very hardline stance taken, only for it to be called off at the last second. It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward. Again, you have the numerous newspaper articles talking about the situation at the border and what's going on there in terms of people being detained. And so the immigration issue, specifically the idea of deportation, this is something that President Trump talked a lot about during the campaign. Has talked about a lot throughout his presidency. It's going to be interesting to see how this moves forward, because I believe that while he has made these very strong stances, there are a lot of people saying, you know, basically holding back, pulling back on the reins, saying, no, we need to slow this down, because there are a lot of problems. This may look good short term, but long term, this can create a much bigger problem than the nation is ready to deal with.
I'll go short on this one. I'm interested in the deportation issue from a framing perspective. This is a media coverage or is a political issue. And I don't mean to downplay the humanitarian side of this, but as a student of politics, I'm fascinated because on the one hand, you have the president and the administration who are portraying deportation as a law enforcement issue. That is to say, there are people who have violated, you know, the country's immigration laws, and the people who are targeted here are people who are, in the administration's eyes and in the eyes of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, are clear and repeat offenders. you know, who have not been responsive to, you know, orders to, you know, show up in court, to, you know, kind of go through the normal protocols of the immigration process. So they're, in that sense, they're clear offenders. And Trump has treated this as a pure law enforcement issue, right? That they violated the law and, you know, they're in the country illegally and you can't do that. We have processes, we have a system, and to not enforce these laws is to invite all sorts of abuses and chaos and problems, right? So that's one frame. That's one way of thinking of the issue. The other frame is that this is a humanitarian issue. This is emblematic of a broken system. In other words, while there are laws in place, those laws are not properly enforced, they're not properly adjudicated. We don't have the infrastructure to actually make them work. And in that sense, all you create is, you know, broken lives, broken dreams. You know, it's connected to recent reports about these kind of tragic circumstances in detention centers down on the border. You guys have probably heard about these things from media reports or social media reports. So which frame is correct? Now, by the way, I think both of these things can be true at the same time. I think they are undoubtedly true at the same time. But from a political perspective, you know, critics of the president would very much like to de-emphasize the law enforcement frame and emphasize the broken system frame and the humanitarian frame, whereas the president is trying, you know, desperately to get people to understand this in terms of law enforcement. And this is common. It's common in American politics where you have two competing sides in a democracy that are attempting to convince the American people that their frame, their way of viewing the world is sort of more appropriate. So I'm interested in this. And as I said, I have sympathy for both attempts to portray this. I think both of these competing ideals can in fact be true. And I'm just kind of watching to see where the American public goes on this. Speaking of the American public, yes. Do you have anything to add on the deportation thing?
Well, just thinking about the competing frames, another great example of this is the drug epidemic. Is it a criminal issue, or is it a health issue? And it's both. And the problem is, when it becomes both, it becomes very complicated. To what degree should somebody be medicated or treated? To what degree should somebody be punished? You are seeing some things come forward in terms of, like, drug courts, which are kind of trying to achieve both goals. But I think the idea of having these multiple frames, which you see all the time within most policy issues, whether it be we're talking about immigration, we're talking about drug addiction, where we're talking about energy policy, there's always multiple frames, multiple ways of understanding these things. And understanding which frame wins out plays a big role in dictating the future of policy.
Right, that's exactly right. I mean, look, you know, Professor McDaniel and I have talked about this class kind of globally a lot in the past few years. And, you know, one of the things we think is our obligation as professors is to, you know, to sort of take into account the fact that politics are complex and that different viewpoints can, in fact, both be valid. And the question is, how do you navigate, how do you negotiate public policy, you know, settlements or agreements under those circumstances and conditions, particularly when both sides, you know, the sides who adhere to one frame versus the other are so intense in their preferences, you know, it becomes really tricky. And that's kind of where we are in American politics. So with that, we'll go to our third and final topic. We're going to talk about the Democratic debates. Now, we're going to show a brief video that was prepared by Time. It occurred to us that, you know, one of the utilities of a summer class, especially the year before the election year, is that you're beginning to see, you know, the contours of the 2020 presidential election shape up. And so what we're going to show you initially is about a 5-minute segment prepared by Time on the Democratic candidates. So if nothing else out of this, you know, in the news number 4 segment, you'll get a sense of who the Democratic candidates are. When we come back after that, we'll talk a little bit about the debate that they're going, or the debates, I should say, plural, that they're going to engage in later this week. So real quickly, a who's who on the Democratic side.
Democrats are lining up to run against Donald Trump. With the 2020 election still a ways away, an unusually large number of candidates have announced they are running, or hinted strongly that they will. Here's a look at some of the major names who have joined the race so far. Williamson is a self-help author known for being Oprah Winfrey's spiritual advisor. With no prior political experience, she is running a campaign calling for a moral and spiritual awakening in the United States. A former deputy district attorney and city council member in California, Swalwell was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2012. His campaign is focused on gun safety, including an assault weapons ban. A former state lawmaker, Ryan was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 2003. After an unsuccessful challenge to Speaker Nancy Pelosi in 2016, he announced a presidential run with an emphasis on manufacturing and trade policy. An attorney and law professor, Steve Bullock was elected governor of Montana in 2012 and re-elected in 2016. His campaign is focused on addressing money in politics and stressing his ability to reach out to red state voters on progressive issues. De Blasio served as public advocate for New York City before being elected mayor in 2013 and re-elected in 2017. His campaign is based on addressing economic inequality, touting his achievements in adding universal pre-K, paid sick days, and living wage legislation in the city. Michael Bennett served in the Attorney General's office under Bill Clinton and as superintendent of Denver schools before moving to the Senate in 2009. A moderate known for his work on education and immigration reform, his campaign is focused on economic opportunity. A seven-term senator from Delaware, Biden served as vice president for two terms under Barack Obama. A centrist who stresses bipartisanship, he ran unsuccessfully for the Democratic nomination in 1988 and 2008. A Harvard graduate and former Marine, Seth Moulton has represented Massachusetts in the House since 2015. Member of a moderate, fiscally responsible caucus, he has backed challenges to Nancy Pelosi's leadership in the past. Andrew Yang is a Silicon Valley entrepreneur who has worked in a number of successful startups. He is running a campaign based on out-of-the-box ideas like a universal basic income, a monthly check from the government sent to every adult. O'Rourke is a former city council member from El Paso and three-term member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He first gained national attention when he ran unsuccessfully for the Senate against Ted Cruz. A former geologist and brewpub owner, Hickenlooper served two terms as mayor of Denver and two terms as governor of Colorado. He is campaigning as a moderate who can work together with Republicans to address issues like climate change and healthcare. A former member of the House of Representatives and two-term governor of Washington State, Inslee is not as well known as some of the other candidates, but he hopes a strong campaign centered on bold action on climate change will help him break out of the pack. The former mayor of Burlington, Vermont, Sanders was the runner-up in the 2016 Democratic presidential primary. He is running on an unapologetically liberal platform, including single-payer healthcare and tuition-free college. A former corporate lawyer and county attorney, Klobuchar was elected to the Senate in 2006 and has one of the highest approval ratings for a senator. She has said if she runs, she would stress her record of bipartisan cooperation. The former mayor of Newark, Booker has represented New Jersey in the Senate since 2013. His campaign is focused on an uplifting message of bringing Americans together. The mayor of South Bend, Indiana since 2012, Buttigieg has an unusual resume for a presidential candidate, but he thinks his underdog status will help him if voters are looking for an outsider. The former Starbucks CEO had a long and successful career in business. He is now mulling a self-financed run as a centrist independent focused on issues like the national debt. A former district attorney and state attorney general in California, Harris was elected to the Senate in 2016. Her campaign slogan, "For the People," draws on her experience as a prosecutor. The former mayor of San Antonio and Housing and Urban Development Secretary, Castro has an unusual resume for a presidential candidate, but he believes his arguments on hot-button issues like immigration can help him break out. An Iraq veteran and former state lawmaker, Gabbard was the first Hindu elected to Congress, but her past opposition to gay marriage and interactions with Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad make her a long shot in the Democratic primary. A former member of the House from upstate New York, Gillibrand has moved to the left since taking Hillary Clinton's old Senate seat in 2009. In announcing her run, she cited her experience as a young mom. As a law professor, Warren helped create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau before joining the Senate in 2012. She's long advocated for tougher rules on banks and corporations and pocketbook issues like student loan reform.
Well, if your head's buzzing, you're not alone. That's a lot of Democratic candidates. One of the things we wanted to emphasize as we kind of tee this up is that this is unusual. For those of you, and I assume this is most of you, who are coming to a presidential election for the first time, maybe the second time, having 23, 24 declared candidates on one side is really pretty striking. The only thing that's even remotely comparable is in 1972, where the Democrats had roughly a comparable number, 17 to 23 or 24. I can't remember exactly how many it was. Nothing else has been like this. And what I would suggest to you, and this is something we touch on a little bit when we get to the module on nomination politics and primary processes, is that it's emblematic of an era in which the political parties, formal political parties, no longer control, certainly do not dominate the selection of candidates. There's a wonderful book called The United States of Ambition. It's a little out of date now, but by a guy named Alan Ehrenhalt. And in The United States of Ambition, he has a simple question. He asks, who sent these guys? And he has a simple answer. He says, they sent themselves. And that is a fundamental truth of American elections these days, which is the parties cannot screen candidates out. Ask the Republicans after 2016 how successful they were in kind of controlling that process. And I think the Democrats are in the same boat right now. So it's a free-for-all. And it begins, in some sense, Wednesday and Thursday of this week. I've just got a couple of slides we prepared real briefly to intro or to segue into the debates. If we can put the first one up, there's going to be two nights of debates. The first night, they're both going to be in Miami, both going to be run by NBC or NBC News, MSNBC, the whole sort of NBC conglomerate. So with 23 or 24 candidates, you might ask yourself, well, how did they figure out you know, who's going to be in this thing? They had a criteria by which you had a certain amount in the polls, national polls prior to the debate, or if you raised a certain amount of money, showed a certain amount of support across the states, you crossed a threshold and gained access to these debates. And so 20 candidates met that threshold. And now, those of you who know anything about news know that you can't put 20 candidates on a single platform, single stage in one night. It's just going to be, it's WrestleMania doesn't even try to do that.
Yes.
Right? So what do? Well, they randomly assigned 10 candidates to night one and 10 candidates to night two. So what you've got night one, which is this Wednesday, June 26th, are these 10 candidates. You guys take a look at the slide right here. So you got, and this is arrayed in where they're going to be on the stage. So from 1 to 10, I believe that's left to right as you're looking at the candidates. All right, so you got de Blasio from New York City, Ryan, Castro, Booker, Warren, O'Rourke, Klobuchar, Gabbard, Inslee, and Delaney. If you'd asked me about Delaney before that video I just saw, I'd be staring at you numbly. So that's night one. And just to, interesting thing here, really Elizabeth Warren, in terms of the polls, which we'll get to in a few minutes, is the dominant player on night one. She's at about 14-15% in the poll, 13-15%. No one else in this night one array is more than 5% in the polls, right? You've got O'Rourke, you've got Booker and Castro, so Castro and O'Rourke, the two Texas candidates in this race. So it's not that it's not going to be interesting, but just by luck of the draw, Warren is not going to be there with Biden or Kamala Harris or Bernie Sanders, right? She's kind of by herself. Does that mean she's a target on night one? I don't know. We'll have to see. All right. So then that's Wednesday night. Then we can go to the next slide, night two. Night two, you're going to get Williamson. That's the Oprah advisor. I'm looking forward to a little spiritual advice. Hickenlooper. We just like saying Hickenlooper here. Andrew Yang, who I was talking with Professor McDaniel before. I think Andrew Yang is sort of a long shot breakout candidate. By breakout, I don't mean he's going to get to 30%, but he's a guy with a couple of issues, kind of future leaning, universal income. I think it's possible in debate format he could stand out. Buttigieg, who's sort of the flavor of the day, Biden, Sanders, Harris. So that's a real, you know, kind of interesting array at the center of the stage. Gillibrand, Bennett, and Swalwell. All right, so that's night two. All right, so you're going to get two nights of Democratic debate. Never seen anything like this. It's very early. This is the first Democratic debate. There will be another one next month. So we get about a 30-day break. And then there's going to be another one. The second one will be in Detroit. This one's in Miami. All right, so two nights. Other than that, There are a couple of things we just wanted to address, again, on these slides. If there's only 20 candidates, who's out? So we can put the slide back up for who's not going to be there. Steve Bullock is actually governor of Montana and is sort of a glaring omission given who's in. The fact that Bullock isn't in, you know, it's his own fault. He knew the criterion didn't make it. Seth Moulton, Wayne Massam, and Mike Gravel, or Gravel, I'm not entirely sure. Yeah. My apologies to the former governor of Arkansas. I'm from Texas, so what do I care? So there's four candidates who are going to be excluded, and they're already kind of whining about it. But again, you know, they knew what the standards were, and they failed to get there. And if you can't be one of the top 20, you know, I don't know how much sympathy I have for you at this point. All right, so that's who's not there. Now, who's going to be asking questions? It's not a town hall, even though there's going to be a lot of audience there. So you got Lester Holt, Savannah Guthrie, Chuck Todd, Rachel Maddow, and Jose Diaz-Balart. So, and this represents the entire kind of array of the NBC News, you know, roster here. So the Nightly News, Today, Meet the Press, The Maddow Show, and Noticias Telemundo. So a full array. I'm actually banking on the first candidate to speak some Spanish. I'm pretty sure Castro will get that in there. O'Rourke doesn't actually speak Spanish, so far as I know. No, actually, maybe he does.
I'm waiting for Elizabeth Warren with her Oklahoma accent.
That'll be good.
Yes.
So we've got all that going on. Now, just again, on the subject of viewer advisories, how can you watch this? We've been talking about it for 10 minutes, haven't showed you exactly how you can watch it. Up on the present slide, you'll be able to see where you can watch it. You can live stream it or watch it on traditional television, on broadcast or on cable. All right, so it's going to be available. So that's 9 to 11 Eastern. So for those of you in the Central Time Zone, I think there's a few of you in the Central Time Zone in this class, that would be 8 o'clock Central to 10 o'clock. So 2 hours both nights, four solid summer hours of Democratic debate excitement.
Debate.
It's going to be awesome. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. No more NBA. Now it's time to debate.
That's right. All right, and then you might be asking, like, well, okay, so you give us 20 candidates. Who's actually doing well? Final slide here. Let's just put the current Real Clear Politics average of polls. So this takes the last five national polls. So we're not talking about Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina. We're talking about state-specific polls. These are all national polls. And you can see that Joe Biden, at right now, a year out, has a pretty sizable lead. Then you've got Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. You got Buttigieg and Harris, kind of running in that, I guess if you got these as tiers, Biden sort of in his own, then you got Sanders and Warren, then you got Buttigieg and Kamala Harris, and then O'Rourke, Booker, Yang, etc. All right, if you don't have a bar here, that means you're below 0.3%, and once again, I can only do so much with PowerPoint. So that's currently. How much do debates matter at this point? Well, you know, what we know from political science is that in the general elections, debates don't tend to be worth more than a point or two. First of all, the candidates tend to fight to something like a draw. And secondly, in a general election, we're all partisans, or at least most of us are. So Democrats tend to say the Democrat won, Republicans say the Republican won, and independents, you know, split. If you do really well, then maybe there's a marginal point or two you can gain, you know, by convincing some wayward partisans or independents that you're the candidate. In the primaries, however, there's no party anchor. So these are basically right now, you know, these candidates are appealing to Democrats, and there's no reason a Democratic voter should have a priori any allegiance to Warren versus Sanders versus Biden. There's no party attachment that distinguishes these candidates. So what you're going to watch, and this is part of the show, as I said, bring your popcorn, they're going to try to establish a brand within these debates. They have to give voters something to hold on to, you know, to put their hat on. Why would I vote for Buttigieg over Sanders or Harris over Booker or, you know, Biden? What's the brand? What do I walk away with from these debates? And there are opportunities. Now, 2 hours, you know, you figure there'll be some uncomfortable drug ads in the middle of these things somewhere.
Yeah, very much so.
Right? So beyond that, so it's 2 hours, 60 minutes times two. It's 120 minutes divided amongst 10 candidates. At most, that's 12 minutes of airtime. Probably less. Let's say 10.
Because they're going to ask questions.
Yeah, questions and commercials. So let's say 10 minutes. 10 minutes to establish your brand, right? And you have to be responsive to questions, but you have to go beyond that and actually kind of identify. Are you the progressive? Are you the universal income person or the free college for everybody person? Are you, you know, the moderate, the progressive? You know, where are you on social issues? What's your calling card? And you have to lay that down in this debate because you're not going to get many shots. Used to be that the early contests were really, really decisive, and they're still important. So Iowa, New Hampshire, early in 2020 are going to be big deals. But right now there's a sorting process, right? If you don't make the cut in these debates, you're not going to attract volunteers, you're not going to attract money, and those things are necessary to be successful down the line. So that's why the stakes are pretty high. And if you're asking, why, are these more candidates than usual? The answer is yes. If you're asking, is this process starting earlier than usual? The answer is yes. So it is a little unusual, but as I said, I'm kind of tired of The Bachelorette and Below Deck. So I'm interested in, I can't even get the Astros. So I'm interested in any kind of entertainment. This is entertainment, right? Professor McDaniel?
I've gone through most of my Netflix shows, so.
I'm looking at that Jennifer Aniston, Adam Sandler one. I just continue to be fascinated by Adam Sandler's ability to have girlfriends way above his station in his movies.
I'm amazed by the fact that he's still able to make movies. Again, Waterboy, classic.
That's good. I like Happy Gilmore, but you know.
But other than that,
51st Dates isn't bad either.
That's not bad.
A little romantic comedy.
Yeah, but I think he's doing the same thing Eddie Murphy did: make one great movie. And they basically
coast off it forever.
Coasting.
I'm jealous, by the way. I'm not ragging on Adam Sandler. He has a life that I think we all aspire to. So,
But again, if you look at this, and I was looking at this, they have enough to field two NBA teams, not two NBA starting fives, but two NBA teams. All right, so this is a huge amount. And Professor Shaw and I talked about this, and you saw the same thing going on with Republicans in 2016, is the reason why you have so many candidates, partly is because things have changed. The nature in terms of communication has changed with the 24-hour news cycle, with Twitter, with all these ways to directly get out to individuals that candidates don't have to work for the parties to get out. They can find some type of outlet to reach their audience. And if you look at these candidates, you could almost argue that many of them are kind of like boutique candidates, that they're therefore they represent a very specific group and are trying to get their word out. Knowing that they probably won't win, but hey, let me make sure that our issues are being brought out. But I also think one of the major things to be aware of, really over the next year or so as we see this play out, is I expect things that are outside of the campaign to really dictate what happens. Some type of shock to the system, whether it be a really bad hurricane season, which will lead to more support for those who want to do something regarding climate change, whether it be some type of economic shutdown, which would, again, benefit somebody like Senator Elizabeth Warren. I could see something outside is going to happen. Outside the system is going to happen. I think that is what will really shake things up and push people out. Now, I think by the time people go to the polls, you won't have 24. You probably might be down to maybe 16. There'll be a bunch of people that'll drop out, and in time, it'll make sense. But right now, it looks like Biden's in the lead. In many cases, it's like it's Biden's game to lose, and he seems to find a way to do it. But expect everybody to try to get their sound bite in, somebody to get their catchphrase in. It's going to be fun. And I think you have something particular about this regarding the catchphrases, things to look out for.
I did. I have made available to you, because we care about you, the consumer, a Democratic candidate bingo card. So if you weren't intending on watching this because you just didn't quite know how to structure it, you got a bingo game now that you can play. Actually, it was done by a friend of mine, a high school friend, Beth Wolfensberger. It's a great name.
Yes, it is.
She went out with one of my best friend in high school, and we're Facebook friends or whatever. But she's a freelance artist and cartoonist, and she does stuff for publications in Boston. And so she sent this out the other day, and I told her I was going to set my class up with it. So you guys can sit and view at the comfort of your own home or dorm or wherever you happen to be, play along. There's some good spaces on it. I like the man interrupts woman card. I thought that was pretty good. I like the sweating profusely. Those are all good spaces to have, and you got your free Democratic space in the middle there. So enjoy it. Look, we're in politics for the entertainment value in a lot of ways, and this is going to be very entertaining. I'll close with one substantive kind of observation, at least hopefully substantive. I think one of the interesting dynamics in this process unfolds is the extent to which the old Democratic Party, the party that was established during the New Deal, that was labor unions and white working class, some racial and ethnic minority support, white Catholics, you know, in the white South. This is a party that doesn't really exist anymore. That's not the Democratic Party of today. But Joe Biden, to the extent that that old coalition can be resurrected, Joe Biden is a guy that might be able to do that. I'm not convinced that coalition can be resurrected. I'm not sure that the inherent tensions between, you know, say, lower class white Southerners, lower status workers, white workers, and white liberal progressives, and African Americans, and Hispanics, and Asians, I'm not sure those coalitional tensions can be reconciled. But it's interesting to watch a candidate like Joe Biden, who's moderate on a lot of issues, who does have credibility. You know, he's a guy from Scranton, Pennsylvania originally, who's, you know, makes his home in Delaware. Can he bring that sort of blue-collar sensibility that worked for Democrats in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s onward? Can he reinvigorate that? Or is that party hopelessly dead, right? And it's now, you know, kind of the next generation Obama coalition driven by young people, by millennials, by racial and ethnic minorities, by LGBTQ community, et cetera. That's a tension in the Democratic Party that we're watching right now. It'll be interesting tonight, or I guess Wednesday night, Thursday night, watch the debates and see, as you're listening to issues and appeals, kind of ask yourself, what kind of voter are they reaching out to? Because that's where the real action is right now. And the different candidates have placed bets on who they think they can kind of lock down and speak to in the context of politics of 2020. All right, so with that, I think we're done for the week.
Yes, we are.
All right, so we'll be back with a little retrospective probably. I think we got, do we have one more in the news?
Yep,
I think we got five.
Next week's the last one.
Next week, the last one. So again, avail yourselves of office hours. Feel free to communicate with us. We're enjoying this semester. Hope you guys are enjoying the semester and the summer. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.